Now, a lack of knowledge around the benefits of COVID-19 vaccine is being linked to hesitancy among some people. That is one of the findings of a new study by the ESRI. I'm joined on the line now by lead author of that study and a senior researcher at the ESRI, Dr. Deirdre Robertson. Deirdre, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks very much for having me, Ciara.
We're delighted to do so. Hesitancy is a really complex issue. How did you go about trying to ascertain the factors that may lead to it?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And hesitancy includes a broad range of attitudes within that. So this was a survey that was done on a nationally representative sample of the population in January. And what we did at the very start was just ask people what they thought about the vaccine, what was their intention. And they could select the option, you know, I'm definitely not going to get it. I'm probably not going to get it, but I'm not sure yet. I probably will get it, but I'm not sure yet. Or yes, I'm definitely going to get it. And then other options for if they couldn't take it for whatever reason. And then we asked them just to list out, without any prompting from us, what were the kinds of risks and benefits that they saw to the COVID-19 vaccine, and we coded them afterwards. And we also, after a series of other questions about risks and benefits, we gave them a multiple choice question where it was a test of objective knowledge about the vaccine based on what was it reported at the time. So questions about how effective it was, about reducing transmission, about how it had been developed so quickly, about the known side effects, so a series of questions. And then we looked at differences in people who were vaccine hesitant to those who were vaccine accepting across all those different measures.
In terms then of people's knowledge of risks, benefits and the vaccines themselves, how would you characterise that?
So what we found was when we gave people a score out of 18, which is how many of the questions on the MCQ they got correct, and we found that people who said they were definitely going to get the vaccine scored better than those even who said that they probably would get it but weren't yet sure. So it's not the case that it's just a group of people who are saying, I don't believe this information, or that I'm anti-vaccination generally. Even the people who said, look, I probably will get it but I'm unsure, tended to know less about it. And what we found was that when people answered incorrectly on questions specifically to do with how effective it was or specifically to do with how it had been developed, that they were more likely to list those things as risks and less likely to list protection from COVID-19 as a benefit. So we can see there's a direct link between knowledge affecting your perception of the benefits and risks and probably then affecting your intention to get it or not.
Were there any, Deirdre, defined patterns in terms of attitudes towards the vaccine, hesitant or not, in terms of age cohort or community or social groups to which people may have identified that they were aligned?
Yeah, so we looked at that as well, and consistent with all of the international literature in this area as well, people who were older were more likely to say they were going to take it, and men were slightly more likely to say they'd take it than women, and people who were higher educated were slightly more likely to say that they'd take it than people who didn't have high levels of education. But as soon as you put in, when we run models in it, as soon as you account for what people know and for their awareness of the benefits, all of those effects disappear. So they weren't as strong anymore. So actually, it's probably that people across all demographics can have varying levels of knowledge, particularly given that we're in a pandemic where we're just being told about this all of the time. And therefore, those differences actually weren't as important as the differences in knowledge about the vaccine and attitudes towards it.
Now, in terms then of access to information which may enable people to make up their mind one way or another, or may decrease their hesitancy, was the availability of information an issue? Is it how it's presented, or is it an individual's inclination to access that information?
I think that's a really important question. In terms of what we asked in the survey, we asked people how much they follow news coverage about COVID-19 generally from kind of mainstream sources. And we found that those people who didn't regularly follow information about COVID-19 in general were less likely to say they'd take the vaccine. So I think there's probably a source issue, but whether that's related to accessibility or related to willingness to access that information, it isn't clear. And I don't know, there's been a lot of effort put into particularly getting factual information on social media and looking at psychologically how to combat some of the misinformation that's spread on social media in order to try and allow that factual information to come through.
I'd be interested to know, and I note that this couldn't be part of your study, but how much, if at all, saturation and pandemic fatigue play a role in people in January's disinclination to access information? Because at that point, we had, 10 months of a pandemic, and the vaccination rollout was just beginning at that time. So there was a lot of information and a lot of very fluid information to absorb. And you can have sympathy with somebody who's just like, look, I can't absorb this right now.
Yeah, I think you're right. So there's a couple of things with that. First of all, when we collected this in January, we had 67% of the sample who were saying they'd definitely take it. And we have a separate survey that we run every 2 weeks about people's behaviour since then, and we ask them about their intention to get vaccinated. And you can see big rises in intention to get vaccinated across all age groups. So we know that that inclination has been increasing since January. When it comes to pandemic fatigue about watching news coverage, the Amoric tracking survey asked people how much news coverage they're following, and they've asked that since last March, and actually it tends to nearly follow the curve of the cases, where people are following it more when there are higher cases, I guess because there's higher levels of worry and concern out there about the virus. So I think in January there were still relatively high levels of watching coverage of the COVID-19 virus and stories associated with it.
I'd actually be really interested to see what impact the cyber attack on the HSE, in terms of it and the Department of Health's ability to collate information about the localised nature of COVID-19 cases, has had on people's inclination or ability to engage with that kind of information since the cyber attack.
Yeah, and I don't know the answer to that, but yeah. I can say that because we're collecting this data every 2 weeks, that we haven't seen a big drop-off in either people's willingness to take the vaccine or in people's adherence to public health guidelines that would align, you know, directly with the cyber attack. So I think probably it hasn't had a large impact, but I can't say for sure.
Well, Dr. Deirdre Robertson, Senior Research Officer at the ESRI and indeed lead author of this particular report, thank you indeed for joining us. And a poll conducted by Red Sea on behalf of the journal.ie has found a significant proportion of us feel anxious or nervous about meeting up with others indoors. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by journalist at the journal.ie, Hayley Halpin. Hayley, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, Ciara. How's it going?
Not too bad at all. Now, at the outset, we have to say that a slight majority of people are happy to be meeting up with others indoors, but that is in no way to overshadow or diminish the feelings of around a third of people who are nervous.
Absolutely. So I guess the one thing that this poll has shown is that there's a huge mixed bag of emotions that the nation is feeling as the country begins to reopen. 32% of people are feeling nervous about the prospect of being able to meet up with people indoors again. But in the same breath, 38% of people are also feeling excited about being able to meet up with people indoors again. So there's a real kind of mix of emotions at the moment.
I would imagine as well, Hayley, that it kind of depends your attitudes towards it or your feelings about it, how many people you're meeting up with indoors. You might be absolutely fine with 3, but then with 6 or 10 or 20, given whatever the size of the room that you're in, you might begin to feel a bit anxious.
Absolutely. Look, at the moment, the guidelines outline that up to 6 people are allowed to meet up indoors or outdoors with social distancing in place. But, you know, from the 5th of July, it's kind of anticipated that as bars and restaurants begin to open up, more people are going to be mixing indoors, more so than 6 people. And the one thing I did find quite interesting about this poll was, with regards to people feeling nervous, there was quite a significant difference between people living in rural areas and people living in urban areas. 40% of people in rural areas are feeling nervous, whereas just 28% of people in urban areas are feeling nervous. So I guess that kind of does show that maybe people who do mix in urban areas with other people more so on a daily basis are a little bit more relaxed at the moment than people who may not see as many people on a day-to-day basis.
And I wonder how much of the nervousness or the cautiousness about meeting up with larger groups of people is based on how accustomed or not you may have been since the beginning of the pandemic to meeting up with others at all.
That's it. I mean, there actually wasn't too much of a disparity with regards to the over 55 age group and the 18 to 34 age group with regards to those who may feel nervous about meeting up with people indoors. I guess it's just down to personal preference. Look, there may be some people who may have been kind of a little bit loose with the guidelines over the past year and may have been meeting up with people indoors when maybe they maybe shouldn't have done so. But then at the same time, there may be people who haven't really left their house at all over the past year and have been very cautious with regards to the COVID-19 guidelines. So I guess it is kind of just how people feel individually as society begins to reopen.
And it will be interesting, as you've just touched on there, Hayley, to see how people's feelings and attitudes change really as we head into mid or late July, because indoor dining is resuming at that time. We'll also have an increase in the number of people who are permitted at weddings. And for most, like it's 50 now, I think, and we'll jump then to 100. I haven't seen 100 people in a room in well over a year. So I don't know how I would feel about that. Just on the basis of social interaction, not necessarily concern even about COVID transmission.
Look, I feel the exact same. Even, you know, meeting up with a friend or two outdoors these days, you kind of go into the situation being like, oh, what are we going to talk about? Because, you know, there's just that bit of social anxiety in these situations that were never there before. Just because you're not used to seeing as many people as you have done. But yeah, as you said, from the 5th of July, it's anticipated that bars and restaurants will be permitted to reopen for indoor services, and organised events will allow up to 50 people to be indoors in venues, and in large venues will allow up to 100 people to be mixing indoors. So that is a big shift from what we are seeing at the moment.
The poll kind of does really show the gamut of human emotions. Most people, 54%, are happy. Then you have quite a large block of people who have a mix of emotions, might be a little bit anxious or a little bit nervous, moving then on up the spectrum. But we do have people who have noted that they're indifferent. They're 8%, and 1% apiece are both sad and angry about the facility to be able to meet others indoors.
Yeah, that was an interesting statistic there. It's a bit of an odd one. You know, look, at the end of the day, there are going to be some people who are going to be extremely cautious about mixing with people, or who may think that the reopening is happening a little bit too quickly. And maybe that's the emotion that people are feeling there in that sense. But look, for the most part, people are happy and relieved. The majority of the country are kind of excited to see the reopening happening. And obviously there is going to be that bit of anxiousness and nervousness with it too.
Well, Hayley Halpin, reporter at thejournal.ie, thank you indeed for joining us. I want to wish a very happy birthday to Geraldine Cribben from Gemini Hair Studios Prosperous. That's a very happy birthday today from all of the gang. Do remember, you can get in touch with your comments, your requests, your dedications by text or WhatsApp to 0833 97 97 97. Boundary setting for children, and particularly as they grow into adolescence, is both good for them and will stand to them in all of their relationships for the rest of their lives, although it can be an uncomfortable process. And if you're an adult only learning how to set your own boundaries, and it is a learning curve, I imagine you'll have a lot of sympathy. I'm joined now on the line by Richard Hogan, Clinical Director at the Therapy Institute and Systemic Family Psychotherapist. He's also a teacher and writing on this particular topic in the Irish Examiner. Richard, you're very welcome to the programme.
Hi, Ciara. Lovely to be on the programme.
Delighted to have you. I suppose, first of all, a lot of people may understand the term boundaries, but what precisely do you mean by it?
Well, I think boundaries is such an important... Well, what I personally mean by boundaries is teaching our children how to regulate themselves, how to understand that the choices they make have consequences and that every choice brings consequences to that behaviour. And so what I suppose the reason I wrote this, Ciara, is because I running my own clinic, I see every day in my clinic teenagers who have never had to manage themselves teenagers who've never had to kind of navigate a boundary. And so by the time they get to 15 and they've got so much more agency, their parents really struggle. The parents don't know what to do now. They've got a defiant teenager on their hands and they haven't a clue how to parent them. And the boundaries that they're trying to bring in, the rules that they're trying to bring in, it's all just a little bit too late because the child has never had to manage them before. And so it's a really difficult thing. So the reason I wrote about it today is to tell parents, to forewarn them, is to be forearmed that very early on in your child's formation, they need to be able to understand that, you know, boundaries are in place and that if you push a boundary and if you break a boundary, that's okay, the boundary slightly moves, but there are consequences and there are ramifications for our behaviour. And it teaches a child how to manage themselves. And it also, what really healthy boundaries do, Ciara, they teach the child how to make the right decision when you're not around.
Nagab, the concept of boundaries can be quite nuanced, and you've alluded to it there. Some can be pushed a little.
Yeah.
Some, in certain and limited circumstances, more so in adulthood, can be surmounted and everybody is happy with that. But that these are difficult distinctions to make in childhood. And I suppose the first thing that a lot of parents will think of in setting boundaries is the word no. So, you know, your three-year-old, can I play with knives? No. But that it's not that black and white and it's not that simple as one word. I would imagine.
I know, absolutely. But I suppose the key element here is that a boundary should never annihilate the spirit of your child. You know, it's really important that boundaries are healthy. They're not being wielded by autocratic, you know, despots. Mm. They're not about, I have power over you. What they're really about is, you know, Mikhail Foucault says, well, there's power, there's resistance. And so if your boundary is power, you're always going to meet resistance, especially in later, as they gain more agency in the teenage years. A boundary is healthy. It shifts slightly. Like, for example, at the moment when we're through, like, you know, going through lockdown, parents had to change their technology policy in the family to suit what was going on, so that their child could navigate games a little bit more because that's how they were communicating. So, a healthy boundary is all about, you know, being able to manage the child that you have, but also it's really about teaching your child how to manage themselves, how to regulate themselves, because a child that exists in the family without boundaries, what actually happens is it turns into an inverted hierarchy as they move into their teenage years, and then chaos ensues, and then you're slamming doors and you've got expletives and you've got a really difficult situation in your hands. So it's a really good point, but boundaries should never be about power. They should be helping your child how they manage themselves. So when there is a no, they can regulate themselves. Because what happens, what I see as well, Ciara, down the line, is couples therapy. You know, and generally, it might be one member of the relationship has never heard no and has had everything given to them through their lives, and they find it very difficult to compromise. And almost the partner in the relationship has to reparent them. And so, you know, it's really important that as parents, we instill in our children that word no, but we teach them how to manage themselves when they hear it. That's a hugely important thing.
Arguably also that point that you touched on, Richard, that happened in a lot of households, that editing of the policy on the use of devices as lockdown, I suppose, itself emerged and devolved over the course of many months, was a learning moment for children, because it showed adaptability. It showed how to cut your emotional cloth to fit the measure of the moment, and that boundaries, yes, they are hard, but they are not immutable.
No, absolutely. And I think what we learned over the last difficult 15, 16 months is that our children are far more resilient than we give them credit for, and that they handle boundaries. And I think parents, you know, often bring in policies in the family with an error in their thinking. They think that to bring in a boundary, it makes them autocratic or it makes them addicted. Not about that. It's really about, boundaries are all about teaching your children how to manage themselves and to regulate themselves so that when you're not around, that they can make those right decisions. And so it's about shifting their thinking about boundaries. Not a powerful, destructive thing. They're actually about managing your emotions, managing yourself.
Richard, if you could just move around a little bit.
Sorry?
You're falling out, you're dropping out a small bit, and we'd love to be able to hear everything you have to
no,
share with
no
us.
No worries, sorry. Can you hear me now?
Love, that's wonderful, thank you. I suppose for a lot of people, concrete examples are needed really to illustrate how to set and use boundaries.
Yeah.
So, for example, I have a child that doesn't want to go to school, not because there is anything untoward occurring to them in school, but they just don't want to go.
Right. First of all, I'd figure out what is it. First of all, I'd have a conversation with them about what is it that when they think about school, they say to themselves, "I don't want to go." It's generally very rarely nothing, Ciara. There's always something in there, a rupture in peer relations. Maybe they're not striving academically. Maybe it's about playing games. Maybe they want to be at home on their games more. Whatever the issue is, you need to figure out there in a very supportive way, not about blaming the child or sitting down and saying, you have to go to school. You have to have that conversation. And of course, it's always going to be age appropriate. Mm. But your child has to know that they do have to go to school. And so there are, really important non-negotiables that you bring into the family. So it depends on what age you have there. But a young child, and a lot of children, say from like, say, 6 to kind of like 10, they catastrophize a lot and they overthink what school is going to be like. So they really overly analyze what's going to happen in school if someone doesn't talk to them. The first thing I would say is get them into school. That's the most important thing. Get them into school so that they see that it's not as bad as they imagined, because their imagination is always going to be worse. So I suppose the first thing is analyze what is it that they're having that reaction to. And then I would say, getting them into school is a very important thing. The more you leave them at home, the more entrenched the behaviour becomes, the more difficult it is to break. So I would say, a clear boundary is that you're going to have to go to school. This is what I would do for a child who's refusing. I'd say, you're going to have to go to school today. If you're finding it very difficult, we can talk about that later on in the school day.
Well, how do you begin the boundary setting, Richard? It's properly probably the $64,000 question. Is it when a child can sit up by themselves? Is it when they learn to speak? Is it when they begin to move around? And these are difficult, because it's challenging to think of putting a boundary on a small baby. But I would imagine that's where you kind of have to have those baby steps.
Well, again, the brain isn't developed enough to be able to comprehend ideas of agency and sharing. If you're asking a 1.5-year-old to share, that they're not being good by not sharing. I mean, it's just the child hasn't developed that capacity yet in their thinking and in the cognitive processing. So generally, I would say around kind of like the 3 years of age, as they become a little bit more clear in their thinking, a little bit more sophisticated in their thinking, 3, 4, 5 years of age, that's when you start to bring in the idea of, you're not sharing, you can't have this, when they want a magazine in the shop, no, you don't get that every time you ask for it, no, you can't have that now, and you're going to have to help them to manage their feelings around it, because they're going to explode. If you ever noticed that a tantrum is generally not in a quiet space, it's at the till, we're designed for maximum pressure, right?
But your feelings are very big when you're that age.
They absolutely are, and they're also very clear. I mean, a child will know that this causes maximum stress on mom or dad, right here at the till, so I'm going to launch this tantrum right here, and I get what I want. And so you have to teach your children how not to be manipulative, and how the boundaries, aren't going to annihilate them, but you're not going to acquiesce either. You're not going to back down on it. You can't have the magazine now, and the more you shout and roar means tomorrow you won't have the magazine either. There's a healthy boundary, and you're teaching the child that, okay, my shouting and roaring doesn't get me what I want. Now think about the child who learns the opposite message. My shouting and roaring gets me the magazine. You're setting that child off in a terrible trajectory and a very difficult life for yourself and your partner, trying to manage this child as they become very clear about how you get what you want in this family.
Richard, what's the difference between boundaries and discipline?
Well, boundaries are the kind of like the rules that your family should be governed by. And discipline is what you kind of bring in to kind of implement those boundaries.
So it's I suppose, rules and consequence, really.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the rules and the consequences. And it's very important that you're very consistent as parents. It's really important. And it's also very important that you don't over... What I hear in a lot of families that have a lot of conflict is that language is really, really weaponized. If you do this, you're never going out with your friends again. That isn't a consequence that you can enforce. Mm. So your child knows it's absolutely meaningless. And so where do you go from that when the language is so heated and so big? Where do you go? And I would say always keep your consequences manageable and also very doable in the family. So when your child breaks a boundary, that the consequence isn't so dramatic. It's not like a nuclear weapon being launched. It's very small and the child can understand, okay, because of that, this happened. Okay, so there are consequences to my choices, and they start to kind of like process their own behaviours.
Well, Richard Hogan, Clinical Director at the Therapy Institute and Systemic Family Psychotherapist, teacher and contributor to the Irish Examiner, thank you indeed for joining us. Now, Sinn Féin has risen to its highest ever position in the latest Ipsos MRBI Irish Times opinion poll. It's on 31%. Fianna Fáil is up 6% to 20%. The Greens are unchanged on 6%. The Fine Gael is on 27%. Labour also unchanged on 3%. Kildare Focus producer Ciara Noble has been speaking to Pat Leety about this. He's political editor at the Irish Times.
Sinn Féin, for the first time in this series of polls, establishing a very clear lead over its main rivals. Sinn Féin up at their highest level ever in this series of polls, going up 3% since February to 31% today. Fine Gael slips back to 27%. Fianna Fáil, big rise in support for Fianna Fáil, up by 6 points to 20%. But that comes, I suppose, after a pretty disastrous showing of 14% back in February. So Fianna Fáil has recovered. And then the other smaller parties, all more or less holding their own. The Greens on 6%, Labour on 3%, no move in either of those parties. Social Democrats on 2%, that's down 1%. Solidarity, People Before Profit, also on 2%, that's up 1%. And the Independents, who are probably the biggest losers in this poll, down by 5 points to 8% today.
Now, you note the Fianna Fáil increase of support. Currently, Micheál Martin, the leader of Fianna Fáil, is our Taoiseach. Do you think, due to the fact we've come out of lockdown, the VAC rollout is happening quite quickly, many would argue? We hear that those in their 30s will be registering in the next day or two. That's this morning from the Higher Education Minister, Simon Harris, giving us that news. So would that be the reason for the support increase for Fianna Fáil?
Well, look, we should be clear that the poll measures support. It doesn't actually give you empirical reasons why the movement in support has happened. But, you know, I think we can read into this with some degree of confidence that what is going on here is that there is a sort of a vaccination reopening bounce being experienced by the government. Why do we make that assumption? Because if you look at some of the other data in the poll, we see that the public now says, by a whopping majority, 70% of people say that the government is doing a good job on managing the pandemic. If you go back to February when we took our last poll, that there was a majority of people believed they were doing a bad job on that, on handling the pandemic. And of course, that was during the lockdown, during the third wave and that. So we know that there's been a big change in people's views of how the government is managing the pandemic. And therefore, it's reasonable, I think, to assume that that feeds into the sort of views they're giving on political support. So it seems to me that Fianna Fáil have been the big beneficiaries of that in government, but Fianna Fáil were the big losers back in February and again in previous to that in October, when people were much less happy about how the government was managing the pandemic. And if we look at things like government satisfaction and satisfaction ratings for the individual leaders, we see Micheál Martin is up, the government is up, Leo Varadkar is up. So yeah, I think in answer to your question, we're seeing a bit of a vaccination bounce in the government's numbers here.
Now, you did note that the polls just measure support. What is asked by the pollsters?
Well, what they ask is, if there is to be a general election tomorrow, how would you vote? So I suppose we have to bring some degree of political intelligence to that as well and say, well, we know that there isn't going to be a general election tomorrow. But in the same way, that is the only way of getting a realistic snapshot of where political support rests on this. And it's always important, I think, to realise that the most important thing is not who's up or who's down by a point or two in any given month. It's where are the medium-term trends going? And to my mind, looking at this poll and comparing it with other data, there's kind of three big messages from this poll. The first of them is that Sinn Féin is powering ahead. And one of the most significant trends since the last general election in February of last year, when we had, of course, that unprecedented surge in support for Sinn Féin, is that Sinn Féin is not alone holding on to many of those new votes that it got last year. It is building on that progress, and it is extending its support into areas of the electorate which were previously unfertile ground for it. So wealthier voters, older voters, the type of people, many of whom were allergic to Sinn Féin in the past, they are significant numbers of them are warming to Sinn Féin.
You mentioned obviously a general election there. Our previous general elections, 2011, obviously a seismic shift in the political landscape of this country. Now, 2020 was a real, I guess, mess of a year. You know, no party really stood out. You're mentioning Sinn Féin there. They did say that they would have fielded more candidates in 2020 if they'd known the tide had turned in their favour. Can you see a general election happening sooner than the next 4 years?
I think it's always possible, but you wouldn't say at this stage that it is likely. And the reason I say that is parties, very few parties walk out of government in Ireland. They tend to hang on to the bitter end if they can at all, because parties know that the public will view the collapse of a government with some distaste. They elect a government once every 4 or 5 years. They expect them to do the time, and it is not beyond the bounds of possibility that this government will collapse. And you know, who knows what lies ahead of us, not just in terms of COVID, but of other external events that might impinge on the coalition. As I would see it, the point of danger might arise in the coalition when the switchover between Micheál Martin and Leo Varadkar in the Taoiseach's office is due to happen at the end of 2022. And at that point, you know, you may be looking at a challenge to Micheál Martin. Not to say it couldn't happen before then, but it seems to me it is less likely to happen before then. And who knows what sort of implications that would have for the stability of the government. But my overriding view of it would be that the government is unlikely to collapse because it is so self-evidently not in the interests of the government parties to do so. You might say that, you know, we're talking about Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael all the time. What about the interests of the Greens? The Greens, for now, are getting what they want out of government. But if the climate action measures became too difficult for the government to swallow, too difficult for Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael to swallow, what would the Greens do then? And that is another medium-term danger. But in terms of the immediately foreseeable future, I don't see a threat to the government's continued existence.
Pat, just a quick word on Dublin Bay South, a very different area than the majority of Ireland.
Yeah, and that's why people would be unwise, I think, to read too much into this, from this poll, into what is likely to happen in Dublin Bay South over the coming weeks. It's I think a very important contest for nearly all the parties for different reasons. I think it will be pretty competitive over the coming weeks. By-elections are inherently unpredictable. Maybe we'll have a better idea how things are going in a couple of weeks. But and certainly this poll gives a boost to Sinn Féin. Maybe it gives a bit of encouragement to Fianna Fáil as well as they go into that 3 weeks of campaigning. But by-elections tend to operate by their own rules. And I suppose we'll all be watching it closely to see what sort of implications it has for the broader national politics over the coming weeks.
Well, political editor of the Irish Times, Pat Leahy, thank you so much for the time.